not online. This is thecommentary.ca. My guest now decided to mark her 50th birthday by embarking on a pilgrimage walking the 800 kilometers of Spain's Camino de Santiago de Compostela. Her book, What the Psychic Told the Pilgrim, tells the story of how she got the idea to go on this journey, the women who had at first walked with her, and the interesting characters she'd encountered along the way. It is an interesting book, humorous. There are some laugh-out-loud moments, and instructive on what to do and perhaps what not to do, like, say, bringing along 14 middle-aged women. For 25 years, Jane Christmas edited and wrote for Canadian newspapers like the Hamilton Spectator, the Globe and Mail, and the National Post. The full title of the book is What the Psychic Told the Pilgrim, A Midlife Misadventure on Spain's Camino de Santiago de Compostela. It is published by Greystone Books and retails for $21.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Jane Christmas. Good morning, Ms. Christmas.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I can't promise that this will be the only stupid question I'll ask today, but a friend of mine, Herman, saw that I was reading your book and asked me to ask you if you had anyone in your family named Mary.
Oh, geez. Yes, I do. My former mother-in-law, her name is Mary Christmas.
Really?
Yes.
There you go. I'm going to throw my friend Herman under the bus. His last name is Kim.
No, tell Herman that I get a lot of questions like that, and people meaning it as a joke, and then when I tell them, no, there actually is a Merry Christmas in my family, then.
His last name is Kwok, K-W-O-K.
Okay, well, I'll find something to make fun of for him.
There you go. Are you religious at all?
Yes, I am. I guess I'm more spiritual than I am religious. I always equate religion with kind of formal dogma, and but I've wavered back and forth, and I'm sort of a little bit not on speaking terms with my church right now.
And I guess the idea of going on this pilgrimage came about how? You were on a plane, were you?
I was on a plane heading to Vancouver, as a matter of fact, and you know, it was one of those things that you get on a plane and you have an idea, you go, well, okay, I've got about, what was it, a five-hour flight ahead of me, and I thought, I've got to give myself some sort of thing to keep me amused for the flight, and I did have a book, but this thing had been gnawing at me about how I was going to mark my 50th birthday, and I wanted to come up with a great idea, so I thought, all right, by the end of this plane trip, I have to have an idea, a good idea of what I want to do for my 50th, or how I'm going to mark it, and I had, as fate would have it, I was flying on WestJet, which it was the first time I was flying on WestJet, so I didn't know their rules and regulations, but I was told that they don't they don't serve drinks or food on board, and so I brown bagged it, and I also happened to pop into a liquor store on the way to the airport, bought a little bottle of wine to have with my meal, and I was opening this bottle of wine. In fact, I was drinking this little bottle of wine about an hour into the flight, and a steward sat down beside me informed me that there was a major fine for opening your own alcohol on board a flight, and it was something like $10,000. So I thought I was going to be severely busted and figured that was how I was going to spend my 50th birthday, was paying off this stupid fine, and as luck would have it, he took pity on me and brought me a glass, and then we started just talking, and one thing led to another, and he started telling me about the Camino, and as soon as he started talking about it, I just got this big rush of goosebumps, and I thought, that's the sign, that's the sign to tell me that I'm going to be walking this, doing this pilgrimage for my 50th birthday.
A lot of people do this, walk this 800 kilometers?
Yes, tons of people, and you know, it's funny, because even as he was telling me this, I had never heard of the Camino. I had no clue where this trek was. I had no clue how to hike. I, you know, never had really been hiking and never put on hiking boots or put on a backpack. But as I did a little bit of research, I found out that it is a very popular pilgrimage. It certainly was in medieval times. I mean, it just attracted scads and scads of people throughout Europe. And then it lay dormant for a number of years, like hundreds of years. And it just started getting back into popular, it sort of got its popularity back in the last, I'd say, about 10 or 15 years. And now tons of people walk it every year.
And to place this geographically, it's sort of the north. of Spain.
That's
going
right.
Going west?
Yes. Now, where we started was sort of southwestern France, and it's this little town that is just touches up against the Pyrenees, and the Pyrenees divide France from Spain. And so your first day is to start in this little French village, and you cross over the Pyrenees, which is hell, by the way, and then you continue on, then you're in Spain. And it roughly doesn't follow the northern coast of Spain, but roughly that sort of route. But you're sort of more in, you're a bit south of there.
Has it become quite touristy?
No, surprisingly not. And I think there's an opportunity there for people. There were some towns where you could see that it could be touristy. I remember this mountaintop town called Osobrero was pretty touristy. And then Santiago de Compostela at the very end was just really feeding into the pilgrim way of life and the whole cult of St. James. But everywhere else, I was quite surprised at how pure the pilgrimage was and how, if not accommodating, you know, purely accommodating, but how sort of easygoing people were about it. So it wasn't a mass or crass commercialized trek.
So the goal of the trek is to get to the remains of St. James, right?
That's right.
He's a patron saint of Spain. Along the way, you obviously can't, you can't walk 800 kilometers in a day or a week even, so you stop along. What are those things called that you stop along?
Oh, they're called refugios, and basically they're pilgrim hostels, and very simple structures. Some of them were in rather nice places, but, and for the most part I found them quite clean, but you're in a room that, some cases it might measure only about, 12 by 15, and there's just a ton of bunk beds. It's just crammed with bunk beds, and you just snag a bunk, and that's your lodgings for the night. And it's pretty cheap, too. I think it cost about, sometimes 3 or 4 euros a night, and if you got a meal with it, it was maybe 7 euros a night.
And you've got this little passport that you bring to each one, and they stamp for you and date it. Is that correct?
That's right, and that sort of chronicles your journey along, and it also verifies that it sort of verifies your journey along the way. So at the very end of the trek, at the end of the 800 kilometers, you show this pilgrim passport, and they verify the stamps in it, and then they give you a piece of parchment that says that you've completed the whole thing.
And did you still have yours?
I still have my pilgrim passport and the parchment. I actually like the passport better than the parchment. It was such a letdown to get the parchment. And but the pilgrim passport is just lovely. I mean, each stamp is different, and I can look at it now and just think, oh yes, I remember what happened in that town, and I remember the moment I got that stamp, and so on.
How much did all this cost? This whole journey.
It depends how much you're willing to spend on it too. I mean, there are tour operators set up to take you on this, and I just think that's the wrong way to go about it. What I did is I simply booked a flight to Spain, and this is the women that I traveled with too. We individually booked flights to Spain, and that was about I think we got a really good deal on it. I think it was $1,000 return from Toronto to Paris. And then we got a connecting flight as well down to Biarritz in southern France, and then took a taxi from there to Saint-Jean. And really, the whole thing, when I totaled it up at the end of it, including the airfare, it might have been, $2,300 or something like that, which I thought is pretty good for a month in Europe.
Do you use a psychic regularly?
I wouldn't say regularly. I think in the last few years I've started to use one, and I probably go and see her maybe once every 2 years. And now, of course, with this book out, everybody wants me to go take them to the psychic, and so I have gone, I think, a couple of times since I've been back, so that's sort of against my code. But I've always found the psychic world fascinating. And I know as a Christian, it's kind of, it's like toying with the occult, and it's just not supposed to be done, but I do it anyway.
So you'd gone to the psychic prior to the trip.
Yes.
And they predicted a bunch of stuff, namely a death.
Yes.
And meeting someone who was fair-haired.
Uh-huh.
Did everything that she predicted come true?
Absolutely everything came true. And even when I was fighting some of it and I thought, she's not going to... She predicted, for instance, that I would lose an important piece of jewelry or a piece of jewelry that I had. And I thought, and here I was the last... It was the last day, and I was flying home the next day, back to Canada the next day, and I thought, ha-ha, she didn't... Not all her predictions came true. And lo and behold, I left it at the hotel. I left this item of this piece of jewelry at a hotel and didn't realize it until I was halfway across the Atlantic. So there you go.
So you met someone who was fair-haired.
Yes, a fair-haired man.
Yeah, the name's Colin, we find out in the book. It ends happily, does it?
Well, yes. It's still a relationship that's going on, so I hope that's a happy moment. And the book ends happily in the sense that we do meet up and we see each other again. But yes, we've been going back and forth across the pond for about 4 years now.
The psychic also predicted that you'd meet someone famous.
Yes.
And that wasn't Steve Martin, was it?
Yeah, I know. No, it wasn't, although I did have a bit of an encounter with the ghost of Steve Martin, I guess it was, and along the way, and I had become totally delusional along this track, and somehow managed to conjure him up. I don't know where he came from, but there he was.
I'm not a bright person, so reading the book, I thought it could have been him, and then I read later on that it wasn't, and I guess we just chalk that up to a vivid imagination, can we?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. Vivid would be putting it kindly too, Joe.
What went on at home? Because it seemed, reading the book and having finished it, I sort of wondered what went on at home. It seemed just as adventurous, perhaps, than what you went through.
Which, at home, in terms of I was on the trail?
Yeah, your mom was trying to get the sink put in, and she wouldn't let your daughter watch Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, that's right. So, my mother moved in and graciously offered to look after my... I had two children at home at the time, and she has very set rules about certain things, and so she said she would look after things, which she did, but there was a sink. I was having a powder room renovated, and a sink had come in, and it hadn't arrived by the time I left on the trip, so I left it to her to handle this, and I guess when the sink arrived, my contractor wasn't able to put it in because it was too big, and so my mother ended up calling my ex-husband and asked him to make a decision. And if you've been ever down the path of divorce, you know that sometimes getting your ex-husband's opinion on something or to have him make a decision about your house is just not kosher. And my mother moved the drinking glasses to another cupboard, and it just sounded like chaos. One of those moments where you phone home and you go, maybe it's a good idea that I'm just not home right now.
How did they all react to the book, your kids especially?
You know what? My kids have not read the book.
Really?
Yeah. And I think only one of them read my first book. And, I'm not certainly going to push them into it. I don't know whether other writers have this problem where their kids aren't reading their books, but they'll read it one of these days, and I hope they enjoy it.
How did the women that you'd accompanied, or that you, I guess you were their leader, mm-hmm. at one point, how did they react to the book, having gone on this adventure with you?
Well, to call me a leader is stretching it a little bit. I was very much a reluctant leader, but somehow I kind of fell into that role. I have heard from, I guess, from about half of the women who were on this, and I would say that most of them really like it. They thought it was funny. Some of them thought I was too easy on the sort of the nasty women in the group, and others were sort of pleasantly surprised that it was. I don't know. They thought it was a lark. They thought it was actually true to form. But I know that there are a couple of women who, do not react to this well, and so be it. It was the most difficult part of the book to write was the time I spent with these women.
You write something interesting that as a male, perhaps I don't
that it's more about sort of making friends with your enemies and so on. I think there's a delicate relationship that women have with other women, and it doesn't happen all the time. I have some women friends that I can be completely natural with, and they're just wonderful and fun, and they don't play these head games. But there's another type of woman that does play head games, and so when they, you know, sort of squeal out, "Hi, how are you?" kind of stuff, and you just know there's a knife in one of their hands that's destined for your back, and you know that these are the type of women that will pretend to be outwardly, you know, really generous and gregarious with you, but you know also that they're talking about you behind your back. So women have to negotiate this very tricky minefield in relationships, I think, and it's finding those women who they do feel comfortable and they can be themselves with. But often we do get into relationships where there are women who are just of a different type.
And does that apply to men too? Do you think is there advice there for a guy?
You know what? I don't think you guys have that sort of trouble. I think I don't think you talk as openly as we women do. And I think maybe that's a good thing. And I think that probably preserves most of your relationships. And I think you guys can get ticked off with each other. Like somebody can do something wrong, and you don't sort of hold his feet to the fire forever and ever, amen. But some women, you know, you cross a woman once, and God help you, you just never get back in that woman's good books.
What does fate mean to you?
Fate means to me that something that might be sort of meant to be. It's something in the cards. It's sort of predestination in a way.
There are no coincidences in life, do you think?
That's a tough question.
Because reading the book, it seems like that something with you. You were destined to do something, meet something.
Yeah.
And it seemed to have all fallen into place. Do you think that happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think here was there's different elements at play here. First, yes, I think that being told by the psychic that I was going, that this is how it was going to play out. And remember, in the beginning of the book, I say that I didn't want her to be right about that. I wanted her to be totally wrong because I had already come up with my vision of how the pilgrimage was going to go, and that it was this fabulous, glowing opportunity to bond with women or to have these just great, rollicking relationships for a month on this trail. And yet she told me something different that I was unprepared for. And, of course, then that's when I said, oh, I don't believe in psychics anyway, and I sort of went off on my own way. But a lot of the things that happened, too, were a result of intuition, of following intuition. And one of those things was, you know, the struggle I had being in the group at the very beginning with this group of women who were really bickering a lot of the times, and also basically telling me that there was no way we were going to make it to the end on this trek, that we were not going to make it to Santiago de Compostela, and I should just give up any kind of thought that I had that we could do it, which was totally wrong as far as I could see. I thought, we can absolutely make it and get there. And so I think we find this a lot in our daily lives, that we have a plan, we voice the plan, or we voice the dream, and then there's people who try to thwart that, who try to either downplay it or scoff at it or give you umpteen reasons why it can't come true and why it won't happen. And sometimes you do have to trust that intuition. Maybe there's a part of you that says, yeah, you know what, they're probably right and I'm just being stubborn. But there's another side of you sometimes that goes, you know what, they're wrong. I'm right on this one. And you have to either say, okay, but to maintain the peace, I'm going to stick with the women and be part of the group. That's more important to me than it is to find, you know, realize my dream or reach a goal. And in this case, I think I decided that, no, I didn't care about the women. It was more important for me. I mean, not that I didn't care about the women. It was more important for me to finish and to get to the end of the pilgrimage to see if I could do it. And I wasn't going to be told like 7 days in that there was no way we could finish it, because I just didn't believe it.
Rhoda Maynard, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her website. She has a blog, and she recently had a post about first lines in books that she really liked. And so I'm going to send her the first line of your book, Impulses, Intuition on Crack.
Yeah. Does that ring true to you?
I think it does, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you ever go back again?
You know what, I would. And I think when I when I came away from it, I just went, well, this is the last time I'll be doing that journey. And but along the way, I did meet a lot of people who had done this multiple times. And even though I have no desire to do the whole thing again, there are parts of it that I would like to revisit. And even if it's just for for a few days to capture what that feeling is of being on the road, of just having your whole life in a backpack and having no worries whatsoever. It's an absolutely wonderful, liberating feeling. And I think that's sort of the big memory that I remember of walking along and thinking, wow, the only thing I have to do today is, you know, cover 25 kilometers.
It's been 4 years now since the actual trip, right?
Uh-huh.
Have you ever gotten that package that you mailed in Pamplona?
No, and I have no idea what I should do about that, but I think it's lost. And something told me at the time, as I sort of handed it over, and this woman threw it into the rest of the bin with the rest of the mail, that I was never going to see that again. I thought it'll be two moons in the sky when that thing, if that thing ever arrives at my house. So I'm sad that that happened to it, but because I have some nice clothes in there. But
the weight of your pack, the backpack that you'd had.
Uh-huh.
How heavy was it when you started, and how heavy was it when you ended?
Well, you know what, it's about the same. Let's see, I think it was about 20 pounds. It was between 15 and 20 pounds when we started out, and even though we shed stuff along the way and having mailed some stuff back, it was still. You still manage to cram things in. I mean, I was collecting maps along the way, and that was all. I mean, nobody was doing any, souvenir shopping or anything like that. But it was just as heavy when I came home as it was when I left. Maybe a little bit more so, but you learn to carry that load, and it's kind of a very interesting exercise for people to go through. We live in a very acquisitive society, and we are by nature acquisitive beings. And to sort of reduce your life down to the contents of a backpack is a neat exercise. And when you get home, you're just almost, you're just gobsmacked about how much stuff you've collected in your lifetime. And the first thing you want to do is try to get rid of as much of it as you can.
Have you embarked on any other holidays like this or journeys like this since?
Not one that was a month-long trek. I do hike with a group that is doing the Bruce Trail in Ontario, and that's about 850 kilometers. But, I mean, we've been at this for about 4 years as well, and we're just, a lot of us are slackers on this one, and we just, if it's too cold out, we don't do it, and if somebody's got if they're planning something that weekend, then we don't do it, and so it's not sort of a rigorous thing. I did hike in the Lake District a couple of years ago and went on a day trek up to a mountain called Great Gable, and it's in, I think the lake is Wasswater. And it was a wonderful, it's just a beautiful and empty terrain. And I was all gung-ho when we set off to hike up this thing. And it was only going to be a day trip. And I think probably about an hour into it, I thought, man, this is just like the Camino. And now all of a sudden I remember how much I hated it. And made it up to the top and back and thankfully in one piece.
I must say I really enjoyed the book. I found it delightful and enjoyed it a great deal.
Thanks so much, Joe. That's really nice.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on... on another travel memoir. This one is will be set in Italy, and it is about a year ago, in fact, exactly a year ago, I took my mother, who is elderly, and I'm not allowed to divulge her age, I took her to Italy, and she has a lot of health problems and, you know, can't get around. She's got osteoarthritis, and she has a walker, you know, she uses a walker. And I took her on a road trip. We just rented a car, and I just ended up driving all over Italy, or we did, and from one end of the country to the other. And we haven't always gotten along in our relationship, and so this was a bit of an opportunity to sort of make peace with each other, and that didn't always happen, but you know, it's a different kind of a trip to Italy.
Man, that sounds like a great book.
Thank you very much.
Well,
it's tentatively titled Incontinent on the Continent.
There you go.
But I don't know whether that's going to pass not only my publisher, but my mother.
Well, we'll await that book with great interest. But until then, congratulations on this one and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joe. Very nice talking to you.
The book is called What the Psychic Told the Pilgrim, A Midlife Misadventure on Spain's Camino de Santiago de Compostela, 2195 from Greystone for the commentary. I'm Joseph Planta.